Good morning, everybody. It's Friday here at Coast Community Radio. The show is called Friday, and I'm your host, Jim Wilkins. Now, I'm really happy to have with us in the studio today, Steve Fick, who's the owner of Fishhawk Fisheries in here in Astoria, and still got a place up in Alaska?
That's correct. Yes, we do.
Yeah, and Steve does fish processing, and so we're going to talk about fish, specifically some of the challenges our salmon population faces on the lower Columbia. Welcome aboard, Steve.
Well, thanks for having me this morning.
Yeah. I'd like to have you just give us a little kind of a history of Steve Fick and a short bio of some sort, and then we'll get into it.
Well, I'm a lifelong resident of Astoria. I grew up here. I worked in the canneries when I was going through college. Started commercial fishing at 18. Got an associate's degree from Clatsop College, then went on to the University of Oregon, got a bachelor's degree, and from there I came home, been in the fish industry ever since, and started my company about 1984, and expanded into Alaska in 1992. So we've been in it here for a while.
Yeah, so basically what you do is buy fish from people that catch it and then sell it to people that sell it.
That's correct. We process salmon, sturgeon, shrimp, albacore, tuna, crab, some ground fish, pretty much everything other than sardines and whiting that comes off the West Coast. Alaska's primarily just a salmon processing facility.
And the sardines, they process them over at Pier 2, don't they?
Well, that's one of the areas that they process, and there's a couple others up there at the old Ocean Beauty plant, and Bornstein's also at their plant across the river, Iwako Seafoods also.
And that stuff all goes to Japan, is that correct?
No, it actually goes throughout the world.
Oh?
There's a lot of applications for sardines.
Like what?
Canned crab bait and tuna bait. Some of it high end is actually longline tuna bait in Japan. There's a percentage of it goes into the can. Some of the lower grade product is used a lot in the king and the paleo crab fisheries up north.
Okay.
Along with Dungeness down here.
Yeah. Now we've seen a lot of apparent concern about salmon runs on the river, and we know, of course, that the construction of the dams really impacted a lot of those runs. In fact, some of them no longer exist. Can you kind of characterize the fisheries in the river before the dams?
Well, sure. Before the dams, obviously back in the 1860s, the industry started to build, and peaked around 1885, 1890, in that time period. And then it had kind of, from about 1920 until 1940, it kind of leveled off to about a 30 million pound production a year.
Hmm.
And it was a relatively stable industry with your natural fluctuations in salmon runs. With the construction of Grand Coulee, it wiped out a tremendous area of spawning grounds in the upper reaches of the Columbia. And they didn't put any fish ladders in there. And originally, when they put Bonneville in, they weren't going to put fish ladders in, but the lower Columbia River salmon industry demanded that we put fish ladders in. And we've seen degradation as we have built dams on both the Columbia and the Snake River systems. Back in the 60s is when they started putting the Snake River dams in. And that had a significant impact on particularly spring and summer runs of Chinook. And from there, we've tried to rebuild.
Yeah. Isn't there a push to remove some of those dams now, particularly up on the salmon?
Well, you know, there actually has been some dams in the tributaries removed, like on the Sandy as an example a few years ago. There's discussion on other hydro projects that are not efficient. But the discussion on the major dams, say on the Snake River, I don't think we're realistically going to see that happen. But we are seeing changes in the way we manage our water to get the proper flows both for returning salmon and out-migrating smolts so that we optimize the benefits to those populations, and which is, appears to be working.
Now, there's been a lot of attention lately to this maneuver by Governor Kitzhaber to somehow control the fishing on the main stem of the river. And I know you've been really involved in that. So kind of tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, for the last 30 years, I've been a strong advocate and partnered with a lot of recreational and conservation groups to bring about the change that we're seeing now. You know, as an example, this fall, we're going to have the largest returning Chinook run since 1914.
Right.
We have taken spring salmon that go over Bonneville Dam and have taken it from 12,000 fish. This year we'll have over 250,000 fish returning. And so some of the partners that we work so closely with had gone and lobbied Governor Kitzhaber to suggest that it would be a better plan if we got rid of the consumer fishermen. I call it the consumer fishery because 98% of Oregonians buy their fish. They don't go recreationally fish it. And by the way, of the 2%, guys like myself are part of that 2% that do not support this plan. But anyway, Northwest Sports Fishing Industry Association, which is a commercial recreational industry group, Coastal Conservation Association, which claims to be conservation, but they're an allocation group out started in Texas, funded primarily by the former owners of Exxon Oil, have lobbied the governor to try to, as much as possible, remove commercial fishing from the Columbia River, put them into side channels such as Young's Bay, and so the partnership no longer would be what it is today. So I hope that kind of lays it out a little bit. So the governor's gone along with that. He came up with what's called the Kitzhaber Plan, where he suggests that he's going to put hatchery-produced fish into areas like Young's Bay, Tongue Point, remove all gillnet fishing off the Columbia River by 2016, replace that with some seine fishing, because he claims that that would be more selective, which, if you'd like, later on we can go into that, which is really showing to be much more damaging and less selective. And sadly, we're building these runs back, and we've got numbers summer, spring, and fall higher than we've had in our lifetimes. And now all of a sudden, we can't share it and remain advocates for those both wild and hatchery production fish.
I'm trying to envision seining on the main stem. Can you describe how that would work as a salmon fishery?
Well, there's two types of seines that would be implemented. One would be a beach seine, which you lay it out from the beach. You've probably seen those in the old horse seine pictures.
Yeah, and they pick them up with horses.
Yeah, and they would pull the net goes down the beach. They purse it into the beach, and then you take the fish off of the beach and harvest those fish that way. Now, in theory, what we would be doing is you get it into shallow water, and then you take a net, look at the fish. If it's a steelhead, it would go over, for example, released into the river. If it was a fish like where you're in a selective fishery, like hatchery production, if it had a clip, you'd keep it. If it didn't have a clip, you'd throw it over. Well, they made assumptions that, well, this will be less than a 5% mortality impact to do this. And so we can get rid of these gillnetters. It was more of an excuse for an allocation change than conservation. There was never any conservation behind this, because the gillnet fishery has always stayed within the ESA guidelines and the harvest guidelines of the states and the federal government. The second type of seine is called a purse seine, and that's where you use that with a bigger boat in deeper water. You could not use the existing boats these fishermen use. You purse the fish is what you do. Is you, you lay this out in a circle, and then you have a drawstring on the lead line, and then you pull it back up to the edge of the boat. And then you would sort the fish that way. Well, the problem with a purse seine is it's very effective when you've got volume fisheries, like in Alaska with pink salmon, for example. When you get a lot of fish in a net like that, they're thrashing around, they rub against each other, and you get a high mortality rate. So I question if that would be an effective way of managing this fishery, particularly when you have such a short abundance period in a river where you've got this big school of fish in there. And that's when you want your recreational fishery on it, because they need about anywhere from 3 to 10 fish to swim by to have one bite at a hook.
Sure.
So you need big volumes in the river. Where the existing fisheries commercially for the consumer exists right now is on the front and the back end generally of the peak of the run.
Yeah.
So we nip along the edges of it and save that large center portion for the recreational fishery. And it quite frankly worked very well. Unfortunately, the governor has decided that we actually shouldn't take care of the consumer that pays for the fish.
You know, I kind of envision a group of well-dressed people sitting at a loft in the Pearl District, sipping on Chardonnay and having maybe just a little bit of brie.
Yeah.
making these decisions rather than people who know the industry and know the fish. It seems to me like the decision-making process is a little warped.
Well, number one, most of your recreational and commercial interests want to see sustainable resources. These are not people. These are seven generations in some cases,
right,
of people that have. It's just part of our culture and we want to sustain that. And to suggest that when you look at how far we've come in the last 30 years, for example, for 50 years we didn't have a summer Chinook fishery. We modified how we run the hydro system, improved habitat. We got our summer Chinook back to healthy, harvestable levels, both for recreational and commercial fisheries. And when you start taking advocates away from that army supporting the fish, it's really a poor decision. And by the way, if you're going to have these guys go sane, it's going to cost for a purse seine about $200,000 to retool with a boat and a purse seine.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't even gotten approval from National Marine Fisheries to do this yet. But they said, we want it all, basically. That's the intent of where the Kitzhopper plan has gone. And it's very sad, and I'm disappointed.
You mean the recreation fishers?
There's a group of them. Now, a lot of them are very disappointed in the Kitzhopper plan, see no need for it. It's mostly the commercial interests that sell the fishing tackle, for instance. What they did was they developed this plan with Washington, partnered with Washington, the two commissions appointed three of their commissioners to work together in a working group with advisors from both the recreational and the commercial industry. And from that, they were going to come up with this plan. Well, they didn't change anything that the governor wanted or even legitimate discussions. And sadly, the mentality of the former fisheries advisor for Governor Kitzhopper finally throws his hands up in the third meeting and says, don't worry about those people down there. They don't make enough money. And so that's the attitude. Jim Martin was the person that said that, and it's public record. And I was very saddened by that because that was one of my former partners in advocating for recovery of salmon.
I remember that.
Personal friend, too.
Yeah.
Very disappointing.
And, I'm having trouble understanding the rationale. But I just want to remind our listeners that it's Friday here at KMUN, and we're visiting with Steve Fick, the owner of Fishhawk Fisheries. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Now, one thing that we haven't touched on just yet are the tribes who actually were the original fishermen on the Columbia. How do they fit into the governor's program?
Well, by USV Oregon, federal ruling, they are entitled to 50% of the harvest on the Columbia River. They came out strongly against this plan.
Now, wait a minute. 50% of the harvest... is that the same as 50% of the fish?
No. The first thing that comes to mind is we need to make sure that we have enough fish for escapement to propagate the resource. So they're part of the management team with the states and the federal governments, that they're part of the technical advisory committee that reviews all these different runs and makes recommendations for harvest levels. And so they have been adamantly against the Kitsopper plan. Cities of Astoria, Warrenton, Seaside, for instance, all the chambers in Oregon has been opposed to it. Two-thirds of the people that voted on Measure 81 were opposed to changing the harvest method. So, I mean, he's, you know, and already, like in the spring salmon fishery, 80% of the harvest goes to the recreational fishery. It's the most valued fish in the salmon in the world, more so than a Copper River or a Yukon King. And the consumer who pays for it only has 20% opportunity, and it'll go down from there under the Kitsopper plan. And I might add on that, too, that the recreational fishing licenses in Oregon do not pay any part of the salmon production or management. That goes to steelhead and trout. So all the management is funded either through commercial licenses or federal or state dollars through the general fund.
Where does the funding for the hatcheries come from?
A lot of that is federal funding.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, we had a strong partnership, as an example, in Young's Bay. That was always intended to be a supplemental fishery to the main stem, never to replace the main stem fishery. But what we've done is as a commercial industry, gave back part of our earnings every year to buy feed, to help sustain the fishery. Myself, several years ago, almost 20 years ago now, gave my land lease up at the Yacht Club to CEDC so that they could have that to put net pins in. That's an example of how we've been working together. And so we strongly have shown that we want to be partners in producing salmon and sustaining the resource in the community.
You mentioned the net pen program. Could you kind of expand on that? How does that work, and how long have we had it, and is it doing any good?
Oh, absolutely. It's a percentage. It's less than 50% of the value of the entire fishery. But what it does is it's a tremendous opportunity to allow some fishing when mainstem fishing's not open. And the net pens is what it is they take fish from hatcheries that fish would return to otherwise. They acclimate them in these pens and then release them so they'll return into the bay off the main stem, so that when you have mixed stocks returning in the main stem, you can't access them. So a percentage of these, like coho, what we call select brights, spring salmon, some mm-hmm. of the spring salmon that are hatchery produced in the Willamette Basin.
And tules?
All, and tules. We use tules in there, mostly to augment the needs for the U.S.-Canadian treaty to produce fish for Alaska and Canada. And that gets very technical, too, because part of that deal is that you produce us some salmon, we'll give you some acre feet of water in Canada to flush smolts.
Yeah.
So it's a very complex issue that has lots of ramifications how we go about this. So It's been a great experiment. It's been funded by BPA. They have concerns about pulling their funding in the next couple of years, which we're supposed to be increasing funding under the Kitsopper plan, and the economics show that the Department of Fish and Wildlife is going to be broke, really scrambling for dollars here in the next biennium. And I don't know. We've got a two-year promise for funding to help augment our losses, which isn't going to go very far.
You know, one criticism that I've heard about the hatchery program is that the hatchery fish end up competing and degrading the feedstock for the wild fish.
There's some very strong concerns about that, but interestingly enough, I looked at a model the other day on spring salmon going back into the Willamette. that are hatchery raised, you will return more to wild streams without the commercial fishery on there to cut those down than if you don't. So their objective of using seines or using gillnets in other ways that they're degrading, they said, you know, Kitzhopper too, he used buzzwords like this is a conservation move. Well, it's not a conservation move. And quite frankly, the gillnet used by time area and mesh size is probably the most selective gear type on the Columbia River, including all fishing hooks. Example of that, we have a protected stock of wild Chinook lower river fish that really drives the opportunity for the healthy upriver bright wild run, other hatchery stocks in the basin. Well, last year, the commercial fishery used about one-third of those impacts to catch 90,000 Chinook. The recreational fishery used over two-thirds of the impacts to catch 55,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the math clearly shows if you're looking for selectivity in what you're going to harvest in the Columbia River, the gillnet did a wonderful job. They use unfair data, like in the spring season, for instance. We use a tangle net, which is different than a gillnet. It actually catches the fish by the nose. You're required to bring your net in every 45 minutes. If you have a lethargic wild fish, you put it in a box, which resuscitates. It's an amazing process.
And it really works, huh?
And it does work.
Huh.
Well, our impact, mortality impact on that is about 12% of the fish we handle. So 12 out of every 100 that we catch will die. Well, and they said, well, you got some sea lions come by there and eat some of those, so we're going to throw another 2% on you. So your mortality rate's 14%. But now the recreational fishery, they came up with a hooking mortality study from the Willamette River, not the Columbia River, that showed about 10%. So every 10 that they kill 10 for every 100 they catch when they release them. Of course, they don't have sea lions eat fish off hooks. You know, so we don't know what that data is, so we are not going to put any additional mortality rate to the sport fishery. So, I mean, they're really skewed information. It's not fair. It's bastardizing science in my book.
Yeah. Now, I know that the hatchery fish, they clip one of the fins.
Yeah.
But after the hatchery fish goes out and swims around for a year or two, except for the clipped fin, is there any discernible difference between a wild fish and a hatchery fish?
No, but, you know, they've done a lot of studying of hatchery, different fish. I mean, fish are like strawberries and blueberries. They're all a little different. You know, a coho's different. Mannerisms are different than a Chinook. And Chinook within their subpopulations are different. But what they have found, hatchery fish appear to behave differently. I think it might be a learned behavior in the hatcheries versus wild fish. And when you mix the two together, they kind of, a guy described it to me once, is that like with coho, they kind of, once they're released into the creek, they kind of act like a thug gang. And they go, and they'll chase these wild fish out of these holding areas and put them into poorer habitat, you know, as they rear before they smolt and go out into the ocean. So that's, they're trying to deal with that type of behavior for one thing, you know. But the good thing about these hatchery programs, like in Young's Bay, is we've got, that fish goes out in the ocean. It fuels both the ocean fishery, sport, and commercial. And then it goes in and it gives some opportunities for recreational fishing in Young's Bay, some commercial fishing, and then it's caught by the commercial fishery in the select area.
I've got one question that came in from a listener, Steve, and then we're going to have to kind of wind this down because Cindy Price is going to come in and talk about stand-up stories.
Okay.
In fact, I think that might be her standing behind me.
Hi, Cindy.
This listener says, I buy salmon from a local gillnetter. Not happy about losing this. Why were locals kept out of the decision-making process, and where do I buy now?
Well, you can still buy wild, locally caught fish, but Sadly, this goes back to the governor's second term. We actually met for an hour and a half in my office, and we talked about his concerns about gill netting. And when we were done with that conversation, he got up, shook my hand, says, "I don't have a concern about gill netting anymore. If I ever do, I'll come talk to you before I make a policy decision." Well, the next time I saw that was in his third term. He sent a letter out, said he's going to have a policy change and essentially get rid of gill netting on the Columbia River, not having a discussion with myself or anybody in the local community about how that might affect us. We'll probably lose 500 jobs, but at the same time, he's done a wonderful job of creating 500 jobs for Nike and Intel, giving them tax breaks, having a special session for them, and we do agree on one thing, and that is that 15 jobs on the coast is worth 500 jobs in urban Portland metropolitan area.
Steve, thanks for telling us what you really think.
I'll try to be more clear next time.
Now, next week we're going to be visiting with Matt Love, a local author who recently relocated to Astoria from Newport. And he's written, I think, 11 books or some monumental number like that. And he's going to come in and talk with us, and we look forward to that. So until next week, goodbye.